Good morning. So last time we talked about the YD664 instruction set. We mentioned this is our textbook's kind of subset of x86, has a small number of instructions, which, you know, be kind of inconvenient if you're writing assembly, but it's really nice for implementing a processor where we don't want to have to worry about all of them. It has this design where the name of the instruction tells you the types of their operands, and to achieve this, our textbook authors needed to rename the move instruction into multiple names. It also has this design where, generally, when we're trying to reference a value in memory, we need to first move it into a register to actually do computations with it. So like our add instruction only works on registers, for example. Not that move instruction. So the only way of accessing memory, like push, pop, call, return, will do. But you know, if we want an operand that's sort of a value in memory, the move instructions are the ones which take it. We have this instruction set, and we talked about encoding and decoding it. So our textbook authors came up with an encoding, and to make this sort of useful, we needed some way to figure out like what type of instruction do we have. And we achieved that by having an opcode in a consistent position. So the first thing we do when we want to figure out what an instruction means is we look at that position to figure out what kind of instruction it is. And sometimes this tells us the name of the instruction, sometimes it tells us like this category. And when it tells us a category, we saw an example with like add, subtract, XOR, and so on. We'll have like the secondary opcode to tell us which one of those in the category it is. And based on the opcode, we knew how big our instructions were and what sort of their fields were. And one of these fields could be registers. And when we need to identify a register, we did this with an index. And we just have this table of all the registers assigning a 4-bit number to each of them. And we also needed some constants. So instructions that had a constant like I remove Q, or had a displacement, a value we're going to add to a register's value to get a memory address, or which had a label, like a jump to a label. Well, those were represented all as 8-byte constants. And we stored those in little endian somewhere in the instruction. And when we finished up last time, we said, OK, so we have our instruction set. Now we're going to try to implement it. To do that, we need to talk about how we describe hardware, and that's going to be our main topic for today. Before I move on to that, questions about these YD6 things we covered last time? Okay. So we're going to describe hardware, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the semester, you know, we could describe hardware with pictures, and in fact, I'm going to draw lots of pictures, and we could build circuits by like drawing pictures and having someone build that. That's not commonly what we do for processors. Instead, we're going to have sort of a programming language for hardware that's a text-based description of the circuit. And it's going to abstract away a bunch of details that we don't care about in this course. And in particular, we're going to use a tool called HCLRS. As we'll see, HCLRS, though it's similar to some commercial tools, it is built for this course, so it assumes you're making a processor and probably, you know, assumes you're making a processor for Y86-64. You know, so it's pretty specific to this course, just to keep things simpler and have you write less boilerplate. There's also a hardware description language defined in our textbook. Our HCL is a bit different from that language. Okay, so we're going to build circuits, and we're going to have this sort of text-based description of those circuits. And one of the things we need in circuits is we need to move values around. And when I talked about manipulating bits, I mentioned in our processor, we're going to have bits represented on sort of physical wires. Typically, one way we represent them is with voltage. So we might say high voltage or low voltage determines 0 or 1. And we'll have some binary value, which is voltage. We'll put it on a wire, which I'm representing by a line here. And when we put a value on a wire, that value is going to propagate on that wire with some small delay, so we can use it elsewhere. This is how we're going to move values around in our processor. And usually we're not going to be moving single bits around, but we're going to be moving bunches of bits. Like here you see you have a bunch of 5 bits. And this might be an inconvenient way of drawing that bunch of 5 bits that in this case represents 26. So maybe I want to draw it like this to just save some clutter. And even that's pretty cluttered. It's going to get pretty bad, especially because we have a bunch of 64-bit values. And drawing a 64-wide one of those would take up a lot of space in my slides. So we're often going to draw it like this. Sometimes I might indicate with a dash and a number how many wires are in this bundle of wires. But often I will omit that because it would add a lot of clutter. And also, I'm going to be a bit sloppy, and I'm going to just call the thing on top a wire, even though really, like physically, it's a bundle of wires. I'm just going to call it a wire, even though, yes, it's not actually physically one wire. So these are how we're going to move values around in our processor. And, well, besides moving values around, we want some way of actually, like, doing computations on values. So we're going to have things that do computation. We saw one of these before. We saw gates. We saw, oh, we have these physical circuits which take in some values, in this case, you know, two values, and output some value, in this case, one bit. And here we see that this is a little circuit here. I've represented with this symbol that does an XOR. If we input two zeros, we get a zero. If we input exactly one one, we get a one. If we input two ones, we get a zero. And the way this would work is that when it receives the values on the wires, with some delay, its output is going to reflect that function of those values. The function in this case is XOR, but we could build these for all sorts of functions. And we're going to just generalize this concept and say, whenever I'm doing some computation on a value, I'm going to just represent that by a box, and I'm going to say that that box takes in some value, in this case it's taking in 12, and computes a function of that value with some delay. In this case, whatever function is of 12. So the output wires are going to contain a function of the input, and we assume physically this is going to happen after some delay for propagating electrical signals. And therefore it's going to change as the input changes, but with some delay. Also something to note is that the output might not be the same width as the input. So this function, for example, could be is 12 a multiple of 3, in which case we'd have a 1-bit output, or it could be, you know, 12 plus 1, in which case it probably would be 7 many bits. Those are all going to be represented in the same kind of way. Okay, so far I've shown sort of circuits and wires, but just drawing them. And we're going to talk about, well, let's represent these in our text format for our hardware programming language. So first we need to talk about representing our wire bundles, which we'll just, as I mentioned, we'll call wires. So the syntax for that is we're going to declare them as a wire, we're going to give them a name, and we're going to specify a width, in this case, 5 bits. That's how we declare them. And then I'm going to connect them to something. And in this case, I'm saying that the wire, the input to the wire, is the constant 26, which I can write in various ways. So assignment here represents that the wire is connected to a value, so it's representing sort of physical connection, which means that in some important ways, it's not going to act like normal assignment, as we'll see a bit later. Like assignment you're used to in a normal programming language, I should say. Some questions on our wire declaration here? Okay, so doing calculations. So here I have 3 wire bundles, A, B, and C, which are each 2 bits wide. And to represent sort of that logic, I just write a C-like expression. And my C-like expression here is that C is B bitwise AND with A. And that's going to represent the circuit where I have 2 AND gates. Why 2? Well, because bitwise AND is every pair of bits. And we have 2-bit values, so we have 2 pairs doing 2 ANDs. And this represents that we're connecting the values this way. And then I'm also saying that A is connected to the constant 2, and B is connected to the constant 3. My B's not look like 5s. Something to note is that the order doesn't matter, since the equals operator here represents connecting something, how the value gets to, say, C, for example, doesn't matter whether it was assigned later or after, because it matters that, is A connected to something? If so, C will get a value from A to do its AND operation. So all that matters is that it's connected, doesn't matter the order. So when the simulator is running this, it's going to look at this first version and say, okay, I want to figure out what C is. Do that, I first need to figure out what B is, and it's going to figure that out no matter where you've written the connection to be. Just like in a physical circuit, you know, if we think about putting a probe here, how that works is going to depend, just look at what back in the wires to figure out what the value is sort of physically, and what's going to happen. And we're simulating that. So questions about our bitwise AND example? Okay, and so in this example, B would contain one, zero, because zero ended with one is zero, one ended with one is one. So that will be our output. So this is doing bitwise AND, sort of simple things we can do in hardware. We can also do some more complicated operations like addition, and our assumption is that it's someone else's problem to figure out how to make the hardware that does addition. Like, we haven't talked about how to do that with bitwise operators. That's a different course's problem. We're not going to deal with it. But we're just going to say that this means that we have some circuit that does an addition here. Now, in this case, the addition, the output of the addition, rather, is 2 bits. That's fine, even though we're going to possibly lose some bits. That will just happen. We just have an addition where we only take a 2-bit result, so sometimes we lose the carry. That's good. That's fine. There's no error about it. It'll just happen. Questions? Okay, so we have our sort of just way of abstractly representing doing some operation on some wires to get a new wire value. Okay, so now we have tools to do calculations and move values around. So let's try to do something useful and realize we're missing a tool we need. So here I'm going to say we want you to have a counter. So counters are certainly one thing our processor should be able to do. It should be able to count. So here my idea is I'm just going to have something which, you know, counts up. So to count up, I'm going to add 1 to something to get to the next number. And here's my way of representing this. So I have wire x. I'm just calling this loop wire x. It's 3 bits. And I set it to x plus 1. And sort of our goal is that, you know, if initially x is 0, then, well, I guess we first need to think of how does it get to be 0, but let's assume we solved that problem, then it should, you know, advance to 1, then 2, then 3, and so on. That would be our hope. And it would do that at some time in the future, and one question we have is, well, how much in the future? But there's actually a more fundamental issue. So one thing we might say is, okay, well, we can write the code for it. So what happens when we try to run it in the simulator? The simulator just gives up. It says, no, can't do that. It says, there's a circular dependency. X depends on X. I don't allow that. You might say, why doesn't it allow that? That's the circuit we could build. And it turns out that this circuit is not something that's going to be stable. Let's talk about why. So what we want to happen with the circuit is, let's just look at the least significant bit, you know, it's going to alternate. But what we've written down here is that, like, it goes from 0 to 1 to 0 to 1 just sort of instantaneously. But that can't happen physically. So physically, you know, we have to have something happening in between. It's not going to be instantaneous. So we think of representing our bits as voltage. There's going to be some in-between voltage. And one problem the circuit will have is that we're feeding this in-between voltage back into the add-one circuit, and it's not entirely clear what the add-one circuit's going to do during that time. Like when we're feeding that in-between voltage, it has something which is neither 0 nor 1, it's going to behave weirdly. And in a way which is not very predictable. Another issue, so let's think about the other bits, is that, you know, here we have something changing from 0 to 1. This might not happen perfectly in sync with the changes in the lower bit. So, you know, just because physically they're separate wires with separate voltages, and probably we can't build it so they, you know, happen at the exact same picosecond. So that's going to be another case where, if we think about what the add one circuit is seeing, it's seeing this weird mixed input. Like maybe it's seeing for a brief period of time, it's seeing 1-1 as the input. And that's going to cause it to try to output a different value. And the overall result of this is that we're going to have some really unstable values. That if we try to build this circuit, we won't get this nice 0, 1, 2, 3. We're going to get sort of these transient values, these temporary values that come from things changing, propagating back into the circuit, and the behavior will be really unstable and not very useful. So this is not how we're going to build our processor, and this is why sort of our simulator just says, no, sorry, don't do that type of circular dependency. I don't know how to simulate that. It's not going to work. Some questions about sort of our broken counter here. So we have this broken counter. So we want to avoid these transient values. And our solution for doing that is that we're going to need some storage. We're going to need something where we can keep the inputs to add one stable while add one's doing its computation, and where we can control exactly when we move on to the next step. Because the big problem we had here is we were trying to move on to the next step before the values were really ready. We want some sort of circuit that will help let us move on to the next step when we want to, not at some point when things may or may not be ready. So we're going to have elements that store these extra values, which are going to be registers and memories. So my solution to fix my counter circuit is I'm going to add a component called a register, which I'm going to draw as a box with a notch like this. This is a register. The register is called count. We'll see that name will appear in our HCLRS code. And this is going to give us our desired effect that will go from 0 to 1 to 2 to 3. And what the register is going to do is it's going to store the current input to the outer. So it's going to store 0, then it's going to store 1, then it's going to store 2. And it's going to do it in a way where we don't have to worry about the intermediate values getting stored. So it's going to update in some controlled manner, and the controlled manner is that we're going to have a clock signal. The reason we have the notch drawn at the bottom is that sometimes you might see a clock drawn connecting to that notch, and that's going to avoid intermediate updates. So let's talk about what this register component does. So here's our register. We have a clock connected to this notch part, which almost all the time I will not draw, which is why I saw it on the slide. And the clock signals that we use in processors generally have this sort of form if I like plot their voltage over time. So we have this rising edge, then falling edge, then rising edge. So they just alternate like so. And usually we'll have one clock signal for essentially the entire processor that will send to every component that cares about this clock signal. So everything happens in lockstep. And the way our register works is that initially here it's outputting this blue value. And then when this rising edge of the clock happens, it copies its input, this green value, to its output and keeps outputting that until the next rising edge of the clock happens, when it copies the purple value to its output, and so on. And the reason why this is useful is that this means that the intermediate values, which are represented with this sort of dashed lines, don't get copied to the output. So the register is never outputting those intermediate transient values, never, because we set up the clock signal to make sure that by the time that rising edge of the clock happens, the add circuit, in this case, is outputting a stable value. Yes?
Wouldn't the clock also have intermediate time?
Doesn't the clock also have, you know, some intermediate values? Yes. And it does also turn out that the register has some transition values here, but it's going to be built so that's not going to end up being a problem. And particularly the main thing is that even though we have some transition values here, we aren't going to care about what the add one circuit is outputting until here, you know, after we've given it plenty of time to have the right input. Does that answer your question? So yes, there are some transient values here, but we're making sure we have the stable inputs for everything all set up before we read the next value. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
Sorry, can you explain the color coding?
Can I explain the color coding? This is just representing values, so I could have written like 10, 20, 30 for each of the colors. Does that answer your question? So the input to the register is like, you know, might be like, you know, 3 bits or something like that. So this blue value might be like 110 is being output here, and the input might be like 111, in which case the green represents 111 being output there.
Okay.
And so on. So that, okay. Question, other questions? Okay, so we've drawn out this. Let's talk about how we write this in HTLRS. So this is sort of the syntax we'll use. So we have this register declared, and we actually declare something which can hold a bunch of registers. So this is called a register bank. Later on in the semester, we're going to have cases where we want a whole bunch of related registers, which is why we have this syntax. Our register bank is named with two labels. So we have a lowercase label, that's the first one, which is the names for our input signals. And we have an uppercase label, which is the second one, which is the name for our outputs. So on this diagram, I've written my lowercase label in green and also represented the input in green to match up, and the output in blue to match with the uppercase symbol in blue. Within each register bank, we have a register name, the actual names of the input and output to the register. Those wire bundles are based on combining these prefixes with that name. So we have lowercase x underscore count, combining the lowercase x from the register here with count, represents the input from add one. An uppercase y underscore count represents the output, which goes into add one. Like with our wires, I need to declare the width of each register. Here in this case, it's 3 bits. And I also need to declare the initial value. So what happens before there's any rising edge of the clock is what value should the register have? In this case, I've said 0. I have my input wire and my output wire. So questions on sort of how we represented our register usage in HTLRS? Yes? I always represent the input with respect to the output?
Yeah, like you're always going to say like the input equals.
Oh, am I always going to have an assignment like this, the input equals the output? That is not necessary. So for example, if the circuit I was trying to build was like, you know, something like this, then I'd have the input just connected to 42, the constant, and the output would be used in some sort of addition that doesn't go back to the register. Does that make sense? Or follow-up questions? Yeah, so the only reason why I have both the input and output on the line is because the output is used to construct the input again. Okay. Other questions? Why does register say input to be output was 1? So this plus 1 here, I should do this in a different color. So this plus 1 here represents the add 1. Shouldn't it be that the output is equal to the input plus 1? So we're taking the output of the register, which is the highlighted wire here. We're adding 1 to it and then putting it back into the register. So I'm representing that operation. Okay. Yes? The question is, how does this relate to assembly registers? So the registers we know of in assembly will typically be implemented using the same physical mechanism that these are, which is why the name is the same. But obviously, yes, the way you access them is different. These are not registers you can just name in assembly. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes. Can registers have multiple properties? Oh, can I? So a register bank, I can declare multiple registers with the same prefix and suffix. So I could have like a foo for equals something, and then I could do like x foo later on. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so we have our counter declared. Let's figure out what it does. So here's sort of how I put out what it does. So here I have a diagram at the beginning. Y count is 0, and X count is connected to Y count plus 1, so X count is going to be 1. And that should all happen before our first rising edge of the clock, because we're setting our clock signal to be sort of have enough space between those rising edges that the add 1 has time to do its work and actually get a stable output. And then, after our first rising edge of the clock, what our register is going to do is going to take its input, which is number lowercase x count here, and it's going to copy it to its output, which means that in the next cycle, after the first rising edge, the output y count is going to be 1, and we're going to use 1 plus 1 to compute 2, and therefore x count then is going to become 2. Then during the next cycle, we copy that x count value to the output of the register, so now the register is outputting 2, we add 1 to that, we get 3, and so on. Some questions on through the timing diagram I've shown here? Yes? So the question is, the circuit starts at the output of the counter. If we trace back the dependencies or values, that's where we end up in this case, yes. That is the first value we have, and everything else is computed from that because of just the physical dependencies in this circuit. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we've seen what these circuits look like. Let's do an example here. So here I'm asking, after 2 rising edges of the clock, what's the value? So here, after 2 rising edges, the value is 2. Asking for this code, what happens? Give you a few minutes to look over this. One thing that you might find helpful is you can try to draw out what does the circuit look like. Or another thing is that, well, the way I would solve it is by making a table like the one I showed you earlier, where we know initially it's 1 and 1. Then things are going to happen. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, a bunch of people. Okay, who'd still like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, E, E, F, G, H, no clue? Okay, so better than 9:30, but not by much. Okay, so let's go through where the solar is. So one thing that might be helpful is here's, I drew the circuit. So I said, okay, we have two registers, A and B, so I drew those registers. Then I said, okay, I just started with XA. Its input is YA plus YB, so I have an adder that comes from the output of A and the output of B that goes as the input to A. The input to B is the whatever the input to A is, so I have this little connection to that added to the output of A, which happens to go two places. So this is the circuit I get. So questions on how I made that diagram? So as for simulating things, so I have initially, before any rising edge of the clock happened, what happens with the circuit? So we're going to look at what happens with these adders, and I say, okay, can I figure out XA? Well, to figure out XA, yes, it's YA plus YB, and I know what YA and YB are, so that's going to be 2. To figure out XB, I need the current value of XA, which I conveniently just computed was 2. If I hadn't, I would need to compute that first and add that to YA, which is 1, so I get 3. Then we have a rising edge of the clock, and what our registers are going to do is they're going to copy their inputs into their outputs. So we end up with 2, 3 after the next rising edge as the outputs YA and YB. They're copied from those inputs. And I repeat the process. So I say XA, I'm going to compute by adding the 2 YA and YB. So I'm going to get 5. And XB I'm going to compute by adding XA, which I just computed was 5. That's the input to A is 5. I'm going to use that again. And adding that to YA, which is 2. So I'm going to have 7. And then we have the next rising edge of the clock happens. So these registers are going to copy these values over to the outputs. So we're going to have 5 and 7 after two rising edges. Those are the outputs of the registers. I could also compute what their inputs are, but the question is just asking for their output, so I'm done. So we get 5 and 7 as a result, which is F. So questions on how I figured that out? Yes?
Why can we calculate XA if it comes after XB?
Why can I calculate XA if it comes after XB? So remember, order doesn't matter. This is just a representation of the circuit, and each assignment is just representing two things are connected to each other. To figure out what their actual values are, we need to say, okay, so here I need to know for XB, I need to know what's the value of XA first. And our simulator is going to do that, just like, and physically, of course, you know, if you have something connected to something else, it's going to use that something else, regardless of when you connected it. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
Just to clarify, the initial values of XA and XB are like 2 and 3 before the first rising edge.
Question, the initial values of XA and XB are 2 and 3 before the first rising edge? Yes. So we have, the way I think about it is like, we seeded 1 and 1 as the outputs to A and B, and before we have any clock signal doing anything to change what registers we're doing, that's going to give us 2 and 3 after the additions happen. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes?
Do the names of the input and output have to be one character?
Do the names of the input and output have to be one character? Absolutely not. Or, so, I guess it depends what you mean. The names of the registers, A and B, don't have to be one character. The names X and Y do. Yes. Which I guess is, yes, the prefixes have to be one character. Sorry. That's the convention that I've borrowed from the textbook, even though maybe it's not the best choice. Other questions? Okay. So we know how to build circuits that count things and store values, and we want to actually do this in HGLRS. And I mentioned that HGLRS assumes you're building a processor. So one thing that's part of that assumption is that we have some things that it expects you to do because you're doing a processor. One of them is accessing instructions. So there's an instruction memory. The way the instruction memory works is that we put in an address and we get some data at that address, which hopefully represents instructions. And in HCL, the input is called PC. That's just a predefined wire bundle. And the output is called i10bytes, which is another predefined wire bundle. From the name i10bytes, you might guess it's 10 bytes. Why 10 bytes? That's our biggest instruction. So it always reads 10 bytes. Maybe you don't use all of those 10 bytes. And the way it kind of works with our clock signal is that, you know, we're going to input an address, and sometime later, it's going to output the value at that address within a clock cycle. It's not going to wait for a rising edge of the clock or anything like that. This is all going to happen, just like the additions, before that rising edge. Just once it has its input. So it's kind of, it works kind of like an addition, except instead of adding, it gets you a memory value. But as far as how we use it, it works like an addition. So another thing we're going to need, because we're building a processor, is we need to tell the simulator what to do. And there's this hard-coded stat wire for status that tells it, do we keep going? Do we stop? And if we stop, do we stop with an error or not? So this is just to tell the simulator what to do. If we think of a physical processor, the closest correspondence in a physical processor would be the circuits that control like the power to the processor. So this is how the processor would turn itself on. This is our equivalent of that. And there's a bunch of values for this, which are predefined 3-bit constants, but we'll just use the symbolic names, which has to be set to keep determine if the simulator keeps going. So this instruction memory and the stat signal are something we need to use. And with that, let's build a processor in HGLRS. And for my first processor, I'm going to implement the simplest instruction, well, maybe the second simplest instruction in our instruction table, which is NOOP. What does NOOP do? It just goes to the next instruction. So to go to the next instruction, I take my program counter, I add 1 to it, because no ops are 1 byte, to get to the next instruction, which is going to be that, and that's what I do. I'm going to have to read the instruction memory, and I'm just going to assume I'm reading a no op, because that's the only instruction I implement, so I'm not going to bother checking. So I'm not actually going to use what I return the instruction memory, I'm just going to read it and ignore it right now. We'll fix that later. So I have my register I've declared, and I'm connecting the output of the register, which in this case is capital F, the PC, putting it through an adder, so +1, and sending that as the input to the register. So I'm computing the address of the next instruction. And I'm also going to tell the instruction memory, hey, read the instruction from where my program counter register is right now. And it's going to give me this output, but I'm not using it, so it won't show up right now. But we'll fix that later, because yes, we probably want to look at it. And I'm also going to set the status signal to keep going. I'm going to represent in diagrams the status signal as a register, but you know, it's kind of internal to the simulator, so we don't really know how it works. Okay, so I have an HCLRS program, and we can actually run this. If I find out where I put my window. Okay, so here I have that in a file. So in a file, not cpu.hcl, that contains it. And if I just try to run that, it's going to say, you know, I don't know what you're doing, and it's complaining that I didn't supply a program to run this processor on. So I need to have a program. So here's my program. So my nice assembly program. And I've run tools YIS. So now we have that converted to an executable. And then I can run my NOP CPU using loading that program. So I'll run this, and it just kept going, probably because we didn't detect whether we had NOPs or anything else. So you can see that near the end here, it timed out after 10,000 cycles, so eventually the simulator just gives up by default. You can specify how long it takes, but by default after 10,000 cycles. We can see that after each cycle, the simulator outputted the values of a bunch of registers that are built in, also outputted the value of R, the PC register. So we can see it got up all the way up to 270F. It also outputs the contents of memory. So we can see here that memory contained a bunch of 10s, 10s. Why 10? That's the encoding of the NOP instruction. And the rest of memory isn't shown, the rest of memory is just zeros by default. And memory here is being shown where we have, so this here is address 4 in memory. You can bind the zeros at the beginning with the 4 up here to get the address. There. And it also shows after each cycle, maybe I should do a shorter example, so I'll tell it to stop after, say, 6 cycles to make the output less wieldy, but it shows after each cycle, you can see, it shows during each cycle what we loaded based on our program counter. So we loaded instruction at address 5, and the simulator, just to help us debug, decoded that to a halt instruction, but we didn't do that. We didn't actually check what it was. We thought it was a NOP, which is why when I supply higher numbers, we just keep loading zeros, which are supposed to be halts, and treating them as NOPs, because we don't check. So questions on our NOP CPU and how it runs, what the output looks like? So that's our running our simulator. Yes?
So you declare the PC equals F, the PC.
Yes.
What if you don't have that?
So one question is, what would happen if I forgot to, if I decided to, you know, make a, so make a, you know, get rid of this line, right? So if I do that, it tells me, sorry, you need to define a PC. You need to set PC, you need to use the instruction memory because you're building a processor. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we have our non-CPU, but we want to actually make this work, you know, whole correctly. And how do we do this? I mentioned when I talked about the status signal, there's a halt option we could use to make it stop the simulator. So we could implement the halt instruction by doing that. But to do that, we need to set this to continue for nops and to halt for halts. So we need to make a decision about what value to use based on the instruction memory output. And we're going to have a tool we're going to use in hardware called a multiplexer, which is basically a funny type of gate. So we could do this with like bitwise operators by hand. We're going to assume someone's done that work, and sort of the abstraction we're going to think about is a multiplexer. And the way a multiplexer would work is we'd have a bunch of inputs. In this case, I have four, and I'd have a select signal. In this case, it would be either 0, 1, 2, or 3, and I would select either the 0th index input 1 through 2 or 3, so on. And this is sort of the building block we're going to use to make a decision. And we could build this out of bitwise operators, and someone will do that, but we're going to have this sort of abstract hardware description language, and we're going to say, well, this can all be automated. Instead, we're going to supply this very abstract version of a circuit we want to be implemented this way. So we're going to represent boxes with what our book calls case expressions, where we have what basically looks like if, else if, else if, else if, else. So what I'd say this represents is we have something, a box where we have inputs 1, 2, 3, and 4, and we get the output as x. As a result, and we have a funny circuit that we don't have to worry about that takes an x and computes the select signal. And the way it computes the select signal is, well, if x is 5, we take 1. Otherwise, we check if x is 0 or 6. If so, we take 2. Then we check if x is greater than 2, and so we take 3, otherwise we use 4. So the way this works out, for example, if x is 3, or I guess I should start, if x is 5, we match this first condition, so we don't bother looking at any of the others, so even though x is also greater than 2, we're going to give 1. It's the first thing which matches. If x is 3, it's not 5, it's not 0 or 6, it is greater than 2, we're going to get 3. If x is 1, it's not 5, it's not 0 or 6, it's not greater than 2. 1 is always true, we're going to get 4. So this basically works like a big if else, and sort of how we would imagine this be implemented in hardware is we'd have one of these muxes, and the hardware description language implementation would somehow compile all these conditions down to a circuit which takes an x and computes 0, 1, 2, or 3, the index to output. Because the way our mux works, remember, is we put in 0, we get A, we put in 1, we get B, and so on. Questions? Yes?
So let's say that if the input is 3, so like what, when in the second step, it executes, if X is between 0 and 6, it should be 2. So why should
it? So the question is, when the input is 3, it says the result is 3, doesn't 3 match the second expression? So this X and 0, 6, this is X is 0 or 6.
Zero.
Syntax for X is 0 or X is 6. Not for X is in the range. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Yes? What the purpose of this is in regards to the multiplexer? So this is how we're representing multiplexers in our text language. And our assumption is that the implementation of the text language is turning this into a circuit that uses a multiplexer. Does that answer your question? So we're not actually going to worry about the details of like making a multiplexer and setting the select signal, because we're going to have this very nice high-level abstraction, because someone else has dealt with those details. Is that okay. Other questions, follow-ups? Yes, back there. So the question is, for 6, why do we get 2 instead of 3? Because they match both cases. It always takes the first one which matches. So it's going to build something which prior, you know, checks the comparisons effectively in order. Yes? What happens when x is 2? If x is 2, so 2 is 2 equal to 5? No. Is 2 0 or 6? No. Is 2 greater than 2? No. Therefore, 1 is true, so we're going to get 4. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we've seen mexes, so let's make sure we're familiar with that syntax, because we're going to use it all the time. So here, you know, the circuit that this is going to represent is we have something which takes in 100 and 200, 300, 400, and we have our select signal being built by some logic that is pretty complicated from Foo. Or, sorry, from bar, because I'm reading the signals correctly. Bar, and our output is Foo. So let's do exercise 1 here. So if bar is 9, what should Foo be? Who thinks 100? 200? 300? 400? Okay, so we have mostly 200. So 9, if we're in binary, is 0B1001. We're ending that with 1, which is the same as 0B0001, basically. And that's 1 ended with 1 is 1. So that should be 200. Questions on how I figure that out? And the way, I guess, the other steps I omitted is bar 9 is not greater than 10, and this is the first one which matched. So even though it also matched the third one, we matched the second one, that's going to take priority. Sorry, it's not choose any one which matches, it's choose the first one which matches is how it's going to work. So how about if bar is 10, what is Foo? Who thinks 100? 200, 300, okay. And if it's 11, we should get 200 by the same logic we had for the first case. Or no, sorry, we should get 100 because I'm reading things correctly. 100, because it's not, because it matches the first case. So we should get 100 and the second one we'll get 300. 100, why would we get 100? Because 11 is greater than 10. That will match, and we won't look on to the other cases. So questions about our mucks here. Okay, so now that we know how to use muxes, which will let us make decisions, we're going to apply that to make a CPU which can execute nops and holds. And now we need to be concerned about instruction encoding. So the nop instruction is encoded as 1 byte, which is going to be 10 in hex. The hold instruction is going to be encoded as 1 byte, which is going to be 00 in hex. And we're going to want to somehow use a mux, one of those case expressions, to decide using the opcode. So sort of the diagram we're going to want is, rather than ignoring the output of the instruction memory, we're actually going to use it. We're going to somehow extract the opcode from it and use that to decide what to set the status signal to, whether to set it to halt or something else, or keep going or something else. Now, to know this, we need to know about the output of the instruction memory, which I told you is called i10 bytes. So I told you that's 10 bytes. How does that work? We have 10 bytes of memory. How do we represent it? Well, we told you in this class we always treat memory as little endian, so it's going to be a 10-byte little endian number. So what does that look like? So let's say here I have memory. So at address 0, I have 60 in hex. At address 1, I have 12 in hex, and so on. What this means is if I supply a PC of 0, I'm going to get this big number. How did this number get created? Well, it's from the first 10 bytes. And we're using little endian, so the lowest address is going to have the least significant part of that output. So the 60 comes from the 60 at address 0. The second lowest address is going to have the second least significant byte. So the 12 comes from address 1, and so on. And if I asked for address 1, I would get bytes 1 through 11 instead of, sorry, 1 through 10 instead of 0 through 9 inclusive. And so my least significant byte would be from address 1 would be 12. My second least significant byte would be from address 2 would be 6. So this is how that number that i10 bytes gives us is constructed. Now, we could use this knowledge along with like bit shifting and bitwise, but we have a different way of doing that in HCLRS. So HCLRS has an operator for taking a subset of the bits, because this is very frequently a thing we're going to want to do, and we have values of different widths we support. So if I have a value on a, meaning like a wire bundle, I can get bits 2 inclusive through 9 exclusive using this syntax. And for this to make sense, we have to know what does it mean for bit 2, and we're going to number bits where bit 0 is the least significant bit, and we count up to more and more significant bits. So now we need to use this to actually extract the parts of the instruction. So let's look at how that works with an example of push queue. I'm using push because it's an instruction that takes up 2 bytes. And push is represented as 1 byte. So if push is at address x, address x plus 0, x, which is x, contains a, or 0. And address x plus 1 contains, for push queue RBX, 2F. And if we think of how this is going to turn out in i10 bytes, the first part here is going to be in the least significant byte of the output. Then the second address, the numerically next address, is going to be the second least significant byte. So our bits, we're going to have A0 in the least significant part and 2F in the second least significant part. And the thing we want, the opcode, is here. And I'm being careful about explaining this because the way you see in the instruction encoding table, you're like, oh, the opcode's first, therefore it's going to be at the end. And it's not quite at the end because of how this sort of byte ordering thing works out. Instead, it ends up being bits 4.8 if we're thinking of that subsetting syntax. Because bits 0 through 4 would be the least significant part, would be this 0 here. So questions on how I got that it's bits 4 through 8? And I guess similarly, this 2 here would be bits 12 through 16, not 8 through 12, because of how this works out. And this causes confusion because in our table, if I like overlay things, like our first byte is 0 through 7 inclusive, or 0 through 8 if we're doing the exclusive ranges, but the first part of that is in our numbering is what we write, not leftmost, because we're writing the bytes where the lowest index byte is leftmost, but the lowest index part of each byte is rightmost, and that's a bit confusing. It makes sense our textbook authors made the diagram this way because it is more convenient for manually encoding and decoding, but it just makes less sense with how this is interpreted as a little endian number. So that these this least significant part, this secondary opcode part, is bits 0 through 4. Bits 4 through 8 are the actual opcode. And then if we move on to the next byte, bits 12 through 16 is where our A is, not bits 8 through 12. Bits 8 through 12 is where our B is. And maybe it would have made more sense if they drew the diagram this way. They're just reposition things. So in this case, the rightmost part of this diagram is always the lowest index. By me repositioning things, there's bits 0 through 4, 4 through 8. It's our opcode again. 12 through 16, we jumped over something to get to RA, and that may make a little more sense. But you can understand why our textbook authors didn't want to draw the diagram like this, because for manual encoding and decoding, this would be less useful. Okay, so questions about bit number? Okay. So with that in mind, we can now make our not halt CPU saying how to declare a mux. My mux uses the opcode. And HDLRS has some predefined constants, so NOP is just a predefined constant for the actual opcode for NOP. So for 1, which is the opcode for NOP, and HALT is a predefined constant for 0, which is the opcode for HALT. And I can write those instead of writing out the numbers. I could also write out the numbers, but I prefer not having to look things up when I'm reading my own code. And you see we compare if the opcode is NOP, I send keep going. The opcode is HALT, I send HALT. Otherwise, I send an invalid instruction message. And we can run this. So I have my CPU with that code. And if I run this on the program we had earlier, we can see it says halted in state after hitting the halt instruction, so we correctly chose to halt, we didn't time out. And it told the simulator where to halt after we fetched a halt instruction. Questions? Okay, so now that we have NOP and HALT working together, let's work on adding a different instruction, and then I'm going to start with jump. So jump means just we want to go to a different location. So to do that, I'm going to start here, I have my NOP HALT CPU, so I have my plus one to advance to the next instruction, I have my stuff that takes the instruction memory output, and I do some stuff to compute the status. And what I want to add to this is rather than always adding 1 to the instruction address, sometimes I want to take the program counter value the jump tells us to use, the place to jump to, and use that instead. So I'm going to add a mux. The mux is going to decide, do I just add 1, or do I take the thing from a jump? And then I need to connect, that thing from a jump. Well, what is that? That's part of the instruction. So from the instruction, I'm going to get out not only the I code, those 4 bits. I'm going to also get out the constant that represents a jump target. And I'm going to use this mux to decide, based on the I code, if it's a jump, I'm going to go there. Otherwise, I'm not. I'm going to use the normal plus 1 operation. So I ended up with a CPU like this. So did some things that are worth noting. So I decided that I name this wire here, the one that comes out of the mux, val p, following our textbook's convention. I also made a temporary wire called iCode and called desk to hold the split parts of the instructions. So I set this iCode wire bundle to bits 4 through 8 of the instruction, and bits 8 through 72 I set to the desk. Why bits 8 through 72? Well, I looked at this and I said, oh, here is the destination of jumps. This is 8 here, this is 72. That's, so I knew how to select those values that way. And if I had an I code of NOOP, I used the program counter plus 1, so representing this plus 1 operation. If I had it of jump, I used the destination value. And I also specified a default case, because HDLRS requires you to have a default case, even if you don't want one. this we've done deliberately because we found that when we don't redo this, people have errors that are very hard to debug. And what I've done in this case for my default is I just set it to this value here, which when it, if it shows up in the output of the simulator, I will notice and be able to figure out what's going on rather than not knowing what's happening. At least hopefully. I also need to modify my stat signal, so I made sure I said to keep going if it's not or jump, not just if it's not. So questions on this code? Before we'll do demo of this, along with some other things. So I have my not jump CPUs, I just have this written out here. And I need some file to run it on, so I have a assembly file here that I've already converted to an executable, which has a bunch of jumps. So I can run my not jump CPU on that assembly file, and we can see if we look up here that, you know, first I load the nop instruction. We can see that on this line says PC equals zero, and it decoded what the instruction was for us just for our debugging. We had to also implement the logic, of course, to do that. And then I loaded the from advanced by one and loaded the jump instruction. The jump instruction contained address 13, which is why in the next step I loaded 13. So we have our load of the jump to 13, and then in the next step, we correctly went to address 13, and so on. Up until we fetched a halt instruction. Okay, some questions? Okay, so some other things that HCROS can do that we should mention just because they'll come up when you want to debug things, is we have some options. So we saw these options here. Probably some of the most notable ones are this interactive option, dash I or dash dash interactive. So if I add that to my command line, it's gonna stop after every cycle and tell me to press enter to continue so I can sort of examine what happens cycle by cycle. See, okay, we loaded not, should advance by one. Yep, we did. Okay, it looks like we loaded a jump instruction, so if I implemented things correctly, I should be jumping to address 13. Let's see if I do that by pressing return, and so on. So you can use this for debugging to go step by step. Also, there's a debug option, which you can use with or without interactive. So if I run it with debug, it not only shows me sort of the values of registers and so on in memory, it also shows the values of every single wire at every step. I can advance to the next step and I see, again, the values of every single wire at every step. So this can be useful for debugging what's going on if you're not sure. Should have the information there. So here I run it with interactive. If I run it without that, of course, I get a lot of output that I just kind of skipped over. A lot of output. Something that you might find useful, and this is a feature of like the Unix shell that you can use anywhere, so you can redirect this to a file. So if I add this greater than and then output.txt, it's going to run this command but send the output to output.txt. And then I can open up output.txt in my text editor and just scan through it, like search through it, which you might also find a useful for debugging rather than trying to scroll up in your terminal window while also using your terminal. Questions on our not jump CPU or using HCLRS debugging? Okay, so. Okay. Right, I should probably. Also point out here that in our debugging output, also it shows you sort of what happens with the memory very explicitly. And it will do that for other components we're going to talk about. It will show you, oh, this, you know, this memory got item bytes was set to that because of PC. And it will also show you that for other components which work similarly. Rather than you need to scan through here to figure out why did it get set that way, it will tell you what's happening. Okay, so we have, so we have our HCLRS. One other feature is there's a quiet mode which just doesn't output anything with the last cycle, which you might find useful. Okay, so we have some instructions that just move around with the PC. So our next topic is we're going to talk about implementing instructions that like actually do things with values. And we're going to start with add, but to make add work, well, we have to deal with two things. So one thing is now our instructions are bigger, so sometimes we're going to need to advance the PC by 2 instead of 1. And another thing is we have register numbers. So we need to worry about those registers. And there's going to be a built-in component similar to the instruction memory that represents the registers, and it's called the register file. It's going to contain all of RAX, RDX, and so on. And our topic for next time will be how this register file works, how we can use it, and showing how we can implement instructions like add. See you next week.